This is Fighting Bob Radio, and welcome. I'm Eric Schubring with founder of Fighting Bob and FightingBob.com, Ed Garvey. Good morning, Ed.
Morning, Eric.
Well, in the spirit of Robert M. Fighting Bob LaFollette, here we are again to learn what we can about what is going on in the world of money and politics, and in fact, this morning, how money and the way the counting is done for businesses, they leave out the costs that they would need pay if they were paying for the natural capital that many businesses use to make profits. And we're looking forward to a conversation with John Talberth, who is the president and senior economist at the Center for Sustainable Economy. He's in Washington, D.C. And also this hour, we'll be talking with Janet Bewley. She's the 74th District State Representative, and she and about a dozen other state representatives have formed the Rural Caucus, and they are going to be holding listening sessions on the state budget around the state, and we'll learn about the who and the why of this Rural Caucus. And David Giffey, welcome. Great to have David Giffey on as well. I believe that we are going to be joined here, Ed, by John Talberth right now here on Fighting Bob Radio. John Talberth.
Yep, I'm here.
Great. Welcome to Fighting Bob Radio.
And, yeah, welcome, John. Ed Garvey.
Good to be on the show.
Great. John, perhaps a question first about this Center for Sustainable Economy. Tell us about the organization and the center.
Sure. Well, the center has actually been around for 25 years, and we started in Eugene, Oregon, as an organization working to transition the federal forest management agencies out of logging the ancient forest and into doing good things on the land like restoration. Over the years, we expanded our campaigns to include everything from fighting urban sprawl to making sure the government was wise in its use of a variety of natural resources. And eventually, we turned into Center for Sustainable Economy, which is an advocate for transition to a sustainable economy. We do consulting work for governments, businesses, and other nonprofits, and we also run our own initiatives and campaigns, such as those around new indicators of progress and our recent litigation against the offshore oil and gas leasing program.
John, you're the author, along with Daphne Weisham, of a report called Closing the Inequality Divide, a strategy for fostering genuine progress, and you direct that particular at the state of Maryland, but from what I have read of it, it looks like it could easily transfer to many other places in the United States. I want to talk about that, but as you know, here in Wisconsin, and Ed Garvey and the Fighting Bob organization have been working hard over the years, in fact began as an organization a dozen years ago, fighting the exploitation of Wisconsin water against the Perrier Company. Ed, you may want to share some of that history and how it relates to what John and Daphne Weisham and others have expressed about the use of natural capital by corporations exploiting, for example, in that case, the wish of Perrier to exploit Wisconsin's water. We also have coal and other issues going on here. Ed?
Well, when we first heard about Perrier wanting to take all this spring water, we went to a meeting that was called by Perrier, and about 100 to 150 people showed up to listen to what they had to say. And after the presentation from Perrier, the person designated by Perrier said, we want to be good corporate citizens and good neighbors, so we want to know how many of you support our effort here with taking spring water. Would you raise your hand? And I think about two hands went up. He said, well, how many of you are opposed to it? All the rest of the hands went up. He said, well, this isn't a valid sample. We don't have enough people here, so let's have another session in a bigger hall. So they did, and the same result. We want to be good corporate neighbors, so if you don't like the idea of Perrier building this plant, raise your hand. Everybody raised their hand, all but one or two. And then they started telling the people, listen, we're going to build this thing. You can't stop us, so you might as well get on board and get a decent price for your land that will be used, or don't worry about paying for the highways that are going to be in need of repair. And ultimately, the people were so angry with the possibility of them destroying this area for the environment that Perrier decided to move after we threatened them with all sorts of things, including going to court. So they went to Michigan, and they haven't been back yet, but I'm sure that one of these days they're going to show up on our doorstep.
Well, John, this would seem an example of the kind of costing that corporations don't do, and that is, in part, the cost to a community in terms of perhaps some social disruption, but also environmental. But the cost of depleting these forests is not factored into the cost of doing business, and that's what you speak about in terms of the natural capital invest costs.
Yeah, well, that's an inspiring story, and I'm glad you all were successful, without having to really invoke a lot of the economic arguments like we're working on. But a lot of campaigns are finding that it is useful to talk about economics. And so there's a lot out there now when companies make these decisions of helping organizations that are battling them to hold them accountable for the cost that they're passing on to others through their land use decisions. So Perrier, they might be building a plant on productive farmland. What are the costs to future food supply? They might be imposing costs on the local community who's going to have to provide community services, roads and power and water, et cetera. Obviously, they're depleting groundwater and depleting aquifers that are necessary to local farms. And so all of these costs are typically passed on or externalized to communities and other businesses without ever being accounted for. And a company that's truly responsible would be at least figuring out what those costs are and working with communities to figure out how to mitigate them as a prerequisite to gaining permits to build or open up a business in a new community. So this is the flavor of what our organization works on, and it certainly has been amplified over the last week in the release of this new international report by the Economics of Ecosystems and Biodiversity, or TEEB, it's called, which is a business coalition that advocates for this kind of responsible accounting.
Well, one wonders, John, if some businesses could do business at all if all of the costs were factored in. We in Wisconsin, particularly in northern Wisconsin, are looking at the potential of a massive iron ore mine, a taconite mine that's been proposed by a company out of Florida, Georgia, that would be one of the largest, if not the largest, open pit mine in the country. And the economic benefit that is being touted is 700 jobs initially, 2,300 jobs, $1.5 billion investment by this company, but clearly forgetting, and in many cases simply ignoring the will of the people, it would seem here, and forgetting to factor in the kind of costs that are suggested when you factor in natural capital costs. The fight against this one may be more difficult because the laws have been changed in Wisconsin to streamline such a such an operation.
Yeah, well, we're finding. Well, go ahead, Ed.
Sorry, go ahead.
Ed?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. Well, it's interesting you mentioned iron ore because in this TEEB report, this international report, iron and steel mills are one of the top three offending industries globally, and their cost that they impose on others each year by this report is projected to be in the range of $216 billion in terms of the pollution to air and water and land and depletion of resources that obviously are getting scarcer and scarcer. So in some cases, you're totally right. There's the business case for industries that just continue to deplete forests and aquifers and minerals and oil and gas is very limited. We have to, and this is our organization is committed to getting us off this addiction to non-renewable resources, pretending like we don't live on a finite planet and instead looking for ways to produce the products we use in the economy from truly renewable resources. And you know, when it comes to metals, the waste stream is certainly something we ought to be looking at. And industry, you know, and businesses that are involved in remanufacturing these days that rely on the waste stream itself as a source of supply are the ones I would be looking for to be more sustainable in the future than ones like you just described that, that continue to deplete virgin natural resources.
David Giffey is on with us as well, John, and David has been keeping an eye on and reporting extensively on the frac sand mining that is occurring in Wisconsin. David?
Hi. Yes, good morning, John, and Eric and Ed. This is fascinating information that you're providing here, John. And has TEEB, that's such an unusual acronym, or have you considered the economic consequences of hydraulic fracturing? Now, and bearing in mind, of course, that you know there are two heads to this monster, as I see it. One is the hydraulic fracturing, which is going on in areas of where there are massive shale deposits in the east and in the plain states and so forth. And then there are places like Wisconsin where our 6 or 8 million year old sand is highly desirable by the hydraulic fracturing industry, and so there are now over 100 very large frac sand mines permitted or operating in Wisconsin, with all sorts of questions being raised about silica pollution, dust pollution, and so forth. Is there information available about hydraulic fracturing and its potential consequences on the economy?
Well, that's a great question, because as you know, this whole phenomenon of fracking is relatively new. It really jumped onto the landscape not too long ago, and one of our goals is to do the economic studies of the life cycle costs of fracking to get some good information on the table. Not a lot has been done now, but what we do know is that the externalities associated with fracking are huge and probably end up making it just as dirty as coal or any other fossil fuel source. When you take into consideration like the land impacts, everybody thinks natural gas is so benign environmentally, but I spent 17 years in the state of New Mexico, which is a very big natural gas state. And if anyone has ever not taken the opportunity to look at in detail of what natural gas production can do to the landscape, this would be a good place to go look at southeastern New Mexico, northeastern New Mexico from the air, and you see these well pads, thousands and thousands and thousands of them, just a couple hundred yards apart, with all the road networks and the pipelines. I mean, that land is not useful for anything else but natural gas once it's taken over. So that's just on the surface. And then you've got the water that's consumed, the immense amounts of water that consumes, and the pollution of the water supplies that comes from that. And then finally, you have the emissions. Everybody thinks natural gas is clean, but when you actually add up the emissions from all the, not just burning of the gas itself, but the production of that gas, it ends up being a net contributor to global warming rather than a something that will help us mitigate global warming. And so these are the issues that our organization is going to start looking in more detail and trying to put price tags on.
That's remarkable. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the biggest problem that we face is always the company or the state saying, we're going to create jobs here. And if you create jobs, it's going to improve the economy and it's going to redound to everyone's benefit. And, of course, they never come up with the statistics to show what the jobs are going to be or how much they're going to be paid or what's going to be covered. So the public is put in the position of saying, well, we're not trying to kill jobs, but at the same time, we'd like to know more about what you're doing and what it really is going to save us.
Yeah, absolutely. John, are the hydraulic, is the natural gas in New Mexico mined with hydraulic fracturing?
Increasingly, yeah.
It is.
Yeah, but whether it's fracking or not, you still got the surface impact to deal with. So that's
right,
you know, that's a given. Yeah. And now fracking, you know, as everywhere else in the country, is taking off in New Mexico. I recently was working on a local campaign in the Galisteo River Basin south of Santa Fe, which, you know, New Mexico doesn't have a lot of water to spare.
No.
And, you know, this is a very small stream that one of the few perennial streams there in this basin that would just be devastated by what is being planned for fracking there.
John, is the implication that, as some have written, that none of the world's top industries would be profitable if they paid for the natural capital that they use? And if so, wow, what are the implications of that? We could almost do nothing if profit is the only motive or the only caution.
Well, I think that's a little strong. They basically said very few of the industries that have a high natural resource component to them would be profitable if they accounted for those costs. So that's quite a bit different than none of the industries in general. So we're talking about rice farming, wheat farming in southern Asia, coal power generation in North America, cattle ranching in South America. So what they did is identify these kind of environmentally, you know, industries with high dependence on natural capital and demonstrated that if they accounted for their costs, they wouldn't be profitable.
Well, of course, we're seeing the result of that, both the natural capital used and the natural catastrophe created with fossil fuel use, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously, the cost of climate change and then the cost of damaging the resources where that coal and oil and natural gas are extracted from.
Yeah. You know, Ed, when the fight against Perrier occurred, it's not likely that people were factoring in the dollar cost first when opposing it. It was probably more a visceral, emotional response, maybe concerns about roads and the damage to roads and the numbers of trucks. But the bigger cost of it, probably not, or was it? Was it a part of it? Do you think people were looking at natural capital costs then?
Well, we certainly talked about, you know, Perrier was talking about the amount of water they would be extracting and taking out in their plastic bottles out of Wisconsin. And we said, why don't you at least share 50% of the proceeds with us in Wisconsin, since we're providing the natural resource. And they thought that was communism. So they said, we're certainly not going to do that. But we said, well, how do you deal with these issues if you can't share the cost? We finally sort of gave up trying to convince Perrier, but we used some of the same arguments with the ethanol industry, as they said it was going to, you know, reduce costs enormously in Wisconsin, if the use of ethanol. They always have something behind them that says, this is going to be good for the local economy, but we're not going to tell you how good. You're going to have to figure that out yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
John, I assume that one of the factors in trying to evaluate the environment, you know, the environmental impact, does it include things like the social fabric of communities and the value of land, real estate, and personal properties and things like that? Are those elements in your work?
Well, yeah, in fact, they are, and this kind of bleeds into the area of work on new indicators of economic progress that we're working on, like, you know, for the genuine progress indicator, which was the basis for the study on inequality we did, because you know, a permit for Perrier or any other industry coming in for the state. You know, it has an environmental impact, and we can quantify those costs, but there's also an economic impact, like on community services and property values, and then there's a social impact. Does this increase the disparity of wealth and opportunity in the community? Does this create stability and good-paying jobs, or does it, you know, create a bunch of low-wage jobs and help bring down the labor market? So this new indicator, the genuine progress indicator we have, is one way to get at these three dimensions of economic decisions. You know, what's the economic impact? What's the social impact? What's the environmental impact in terms of monetary terms? So when a public agency is forced with making a decision to authorize a land use and their governing statutes and regulations rules require them to take a hard look at the impacts, we have an indicator that helps them fulfill that obligation.
And are there people who are looking at that? I'm sorry, David?
No, that's fine. Yeah.
Are people looking at those indicators, John?
Oh, absolutely. So there's an entire global movement now to get beyond traditional economic indicators. I mean, almost every day, there's an article along the lines of we have to get beyond GDP and gross state product, which is its equivalent, and always reporting things in terms of just generically like jobs, which we were just talking about, and incomes, but really looking at quality of life. And so it's a whole field that's developing, and it's gradually making its way into decision making. And the state of Maryland is leading the way in this genuine progress indicator. They adopted it 2 years ago. The state of Vermont recently just passed it in their legislature. State of Oregon is coming on board, and we're flying out there next week to help them get up and running. And six or seven other states are looking at adopting this new measure of progress as a way to start making good policy decisions.
And will that help townships and communities who are confronted with, for example, these fracked sand mining or operations? Will it assist them? We're talking gross domestic product, kind of macroeconomic terms, GPI, another kind of a bigger term that would seem fit for a nation or a state. Will cities and townships be able to use this information? Is it translatable into terms that will work for a town board supervisors to understand when they consider granting an application for a frac sand mine in Wisconsin?
Exactly. It's a great question, because that's exactly what we are doing with the GPI. It's already been done to some extent, is translating this macro indicator, GPI at the national level, which is going toe-to-toe with GDP, to the state level, which goes toe-to-toe with gross state product, and then down to the county and city levels as well. So we're developing, for instance, a GPI for the city of Baltimore. We're in the process of doing that, and it's already been demonstrated. So the idea is to get it in the hands of county and municipal decision makers as well, to help guide decisions that they have responsibility for, like land use decisions.
Excellent.
That's David, good news. Is the methodology accepted in general, would you say, by critics in the Chamber of Commerce or in associations and organizations that are whose members are businesses?
Well, that's another great question. So the first task, of course, was to get these new metrics accepted by economists in general and the academic community. And so we've had, since the GPI was developed in the late 80s, there's been roughly 20 years of vetting in the scientific literature, and it's really kind of come out looking great from that whole process. And now it's the process of vetting it through the state and federal statistical agencies, and again, the receptivity is high because it's just a logical measure. It's just instead of counting everything that happens in the economy, everything we spend money on as good, let's separate out what's a cost and what's a benefit. Let's only count things that actually are really making us better off, and put those in the benefits column, and then put in the cost column things like activities that create water pollution that we then have to clean up. So, once they actually start unpacking the math of it, it becomes pretty obvious that there's not a whole lot that's controversial about the measure. The only obstacles we're facing is just that there's a lot of bureaucratic inertia out there. People have been reporting on whatever they're reporting on at the city and county level in terms of, the economy, jobs, incomes, tax revenues, whatever they're reporting on the state level, gross state product. They've been doing that for decades, right? And so it takes some kind of re-education and pilot projects and demonstration to to open up their minds to new thinking on this stuff, and that's exactly what we're doing.
What information is available and how from your organization?
Well, we've got several websites. Yeah, there's several websites. Genuine Progress, one word, .net, is one that's co-managed by our organization and Daphne's Institute for Policy Studies. At the Center for Sustainable Economy website, which is sustainable-economy.org, you can find information on the Genuine Progress Indicator and what we've been using it for, as well as other metrics like the ecological footprint. So, and then, you know, there's a vast amount of literature out there on various international websites. Like there's one called Beyond GDP that the European Union manages. That's a really great source of information. So there's quite a bit out there.
John, if I may, before we close, unless, Ed, you have a question, or perhaps you do as well, but the Closing the Inequality Divide, your recent report, it centers to a large extent on Maryland, but transferable to many places. In fact, some of the numbers look very much the same as we might see elsewhere. The divide between the growing numbers of poor in the country and the rich in the country, the wealthy, the top 1% getting richer, the poor getting poorer. The title of the report is Closing the Inequality Divide. I hope that suggests that that can actually happen. Some of the biggest, most chief points, the things that you have learned in that report, and perhaps a way out of this, correcting this divide.
Well, sure. I mean, the key finding in the report, I mean, number one, we use the Genuine Progress Indicator to demonstrate that now that Maryland is using this indicator, how can it be used to inform policy debates? And so, obviously, like in every other state in the country, we have an issue of inequality. The divide is getting larger and larger and larger as years go on. And then we've got policies on the table to help close the divide, such as living wage laws or fair taxation or greater investments in education for low-income families. And what the report does is identify, using the GPI as a framework, what the benefits, economic benefits in dollar terms would be of doing that. And it was pretty remarkable because we found that each year Maryland's economy could benefit over $65 billion a year from closing the inequality divide, at least back to the point we were in around 1970 when the income equity was at its greatest. And so, so this report provides ammunition for people working on campaigns like living wages to use some economic arguments that they might not be familiar with yet.
Well,
you
close the inequality
divide. Primarily research.
Excuse me?
John? Do you have, Ed said, do you have a political arm, or do you do generally research?
No, we're pretty much a research organization that we support the initiatives that other nonprofit organizations implement.
Mm-hmm. And John, the report is available by how? I have
say
it.
Say that again.
Your report, Closing Inequality Divide.
Oh yeah. Sustainable-economy.org or IPS-DC.org. Either organization, Institute for Policy Studies or Center for Sustainable Economy, it's probably still on the front pages of those websites.
Yeah. Ed, I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine. That's really the question I was going to ask. We got to get these reports, that's for sure, and get them published on
our
website.
John, thank you very much for your time with us. I appreciate it. We do.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Ted.
Thank you very much.
Be well. John Talberth. John is the author of Closing the Inequality Divide. And Ed, you know, that report, it's really amazing that it points out, as he said, that if we could return to, 1970 or so, when after which incomes seem to flatten out for most of the people and rise for a handful, it would mean a real boost in the economy in Maryland. I hope that the people in government in Maryland are listening.
Maryland's an interesting state, actually.
Yeah, I know very little about Maryland, actually, and as I was looking at the report, I was reminded how little I do know about that state, you know. Baltimore is there. that's not much else. But, gosh, he points out that in 1968, if income equity, you know, if incomes were had risen or stayed at the percentage of you know, the level that they were, relative level they were, it would generate, he said, $65 billion per year to the Maryland's economy if there were more income equity in that state. But it would require some changes. And, of course, some of us are not optimistic about what kind of changes could occur in the state of Wisconsin under the current administrations, are we? Are we? Well, coming up, we're going to have a conversation with Janet Bewley. She's the 74th District State Representative, and she is a part of a new caucus in the Assembly. It's the Rural Caucus, and she'll tell us about the who and the what of that. And so, Ed, what have you been watching this week, Ed?
What have I been watching?
You know, we could talk baseball, but I know that's another subject. But
well, if the Brewers had won yesterday, 10 in a row would have been something miraculous. So I guess we should think about something else. But perhaps they could close the gap there between the rich and the poor. I think as you look at our society this past week or so, it's just staggering in terms of what the reaction has been to the Boston Marathon, the bombing, to the Elvis impersonator who allegedly sent Risen to the President of the United States. It's really a strange moment, it seems to me. We look at the way the FBI and others were able to track down these two bombers. I mean, when you think about two people out of a million or so people who were involved, that they were able to capture them is quite remarkable.
Well, and we're also hearing concerns. David Giffey, several weeks ago, perhaps a month ago, we had a conversation with a member of Veterans for Peace about drones and their use and the drone strikes, drones being used in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the likelihood that they're flying overhead doing other things even right now here in the United States and in border patrolling. The discussion about the use of drones and whether they have been effective in the United States war against the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whomever in Pakistan-Afghanistan area, the questioning of the effectiveness of that policy is being raised to a level that I've not heard until very recently, and perhaps it's taken the death of far too many civilians there. You know,
The impact that these drones have on our relationships with other countries, it seems to me awfully tempting for the CIA or the State Department to pick out people they don't like and push a button and they're dead. I mean, it's just unbelievably accurate and effective. But the consequences are wide open. We don't know exactly how it's going to come out, but I think there has to be some control over the drones in the same way that we try to control the military. Before they start using these things in the White House, there should be some guidelines set down by the Congress.
That's exactly what Jeremy Scahill, who, by the way, is a Wisconsin product. He's from Milwaukee originally, the journalist Jeremy Scahill, whose new book describes the dirty wars and their consequences. It's in an odd way at all. It's an evaluation of the consequences that are yet to come of things like drone warfare, where no one really is accountable, according to Jeremy Scahill. In general, the assassinations and actual people are targeted in secret somewhere by the in the executive branch of government, and we may not even know of these attacks because they take place in such distant places that are have very little communication with the Western world, and we can only imagine if by looking at some of the consequences of the past, what sorts of feelings are generated in the people present, or are the people affected, or the people who survive, or the innocent people that are grievously affected by these automated robotic warfare tactics. It really is something that should give us pause.
Well, when we consider that the day of before the marathon, the Boston Marathon bombing, where three people died and hundreds were wounded, injured, some grievously, that there were bombings in Iraq that killed as many people, perhaps, as were wounded, as were maimed in the marathon bombing, and 11 children, at least as I understand it, were killed, were collateral deaths as a result of a drone strike somewhere in either Afghanistan or Pakistan. And we likely would not have even heard about that drone attack if it hadn't been for the complaints and concerns and the grief of those parents and others whose children died. But it did give us an opportunity, hopefully, to consider those people in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and elsewhere in the world who suffer the kinds far more in terms of death and destruction. And
anybody who thinks that the widespread use of drones is somehow going to eliminate problems for the United States, I think they're crazy. It's just going to increase the hatred for this country by all sorts of people, and it'd be a great recruiting device for Al-Qaeda and others who are concerned about the United States and its actions. So I find it to be one of the most seriously underrated story in the country. Congress has not taken up a serious look at it. I think they'd rather just have the drones go ahead and kill people and they can claim innocence in the Congress. But it's pretty scary stuff as far as I'm concerned.
Well, can we imagine what it would be like, how we would feel if we knew or suspected or feared with some justification that there were unmanned drones with killing machines, missiles on them flying over us right now that were from another country?
Right.
Is the case there.
And the availability of drones is becoming widespread. There was a story in the Madison newspaper this week about I think it's the City Parks Department that has a drone that has been painted and decorated to look like some kind of fierce beast, and they use it to scare geese out of the local waters because they're in parks. And in this case, it's so typical of how we view these. Really, weapons is what the only way I can think of them, and make them available for civilian use or for other uses than military, and because it's presented to us as though it were a real benefit to the public to get the geese out of the park, the Canada geese out of the park, it has this cute quality that can lead to the dismissal of old drones. They're perfectly fine, and I wish I had one.
So do you think the Second Amendment protects my right to have a drone?
It probably would be argued.
some lobbyist for the manufacturers might have some ideas about that, Ed, and how
sure
we
they
might do that. Yeah, Ed, a couple of things have happened in the state here. We've talked about the criticism of the University of Wisconsin system actually having some surplus money just lying around. Apparently, the Republicans in the legislature are upset about the rainy day, about a rainy day fund that the university has. But instead of being $1 billion or $650 million, it appears that it is only about $200 million that is can be considered excess. The university system apparently has some plans in the works for using a major portion of that. But the drumbeat of criticism of the university system by Republicans in the legislature seems to continue unabated, and a few Democrats have even signed on to this attack.
Yeah, I think you have to look at this in the context of Biddy Martin and her predecessor, Catherine Lyle, and Scott Walker, wanting to privatize the Madison campus. And I think if you focus on this story from that perspective, then you think that perhaps the president of the university system, Kevin Riley, and others may have been building up some surplus so that they could not be forced into privatization by the state, but maybe that's too simplistic. I'm not sure. But when I see Mike Ellis and people like that getting so excited, I figure there's more to it than just covering up a surplus. It's not like somebody stole the money. But they are so angered by this, and I think it's because Walker and his folks still want to be able to say that they privatized the Madison campus of the University of Wisconsin.
Well, they talk about lowering tuition rates. David, go ahead. Sorry.
It applies too widely in Wisconsin to every all of the 424 public school districts, I would say, because the there are all these paradoxes at work in the budgeting, and it isn't just the Republican administrations in Wisconsin that have cut the budget for higher education for the UW system, but on the one hand, there has been this outcry about costs and budgeting and the need for austerity, and therefore the education budgets, be it for the UW system or for public schools, have been cut and reduced consistently. And then the UW system has raised tuition fees. But as I understand it, the UW still ranks in the very bottom of tuition costs, and not that they're not outrageous, but it's been encouraged by legislation that reduces aid to education in general, so that this great land grant university is seen as having this enormous rainy day fund, when in fact it's something like 23% of the budget, which, as I understand it, is well below the other Big Ten schools, some of which have as much as 60% of surplus in abeyance for in times of need, and therefore they can increase salaries to professors, they can do the things that students need rather than things that private corporations need.
But there's outcry from Republicans saying, oh, my God, now we're going to have to freeze tuition. It just strikes me as being about as disingenuous as you can be, because they're not concerned about the students paying more in tuition. They're concerned about their control over the Madison campus.
Absolutely, yeah.
David, please.
Well, I was just going to make one final statement about the comparison to public school districts, where there has been a rule of thumb, as I understand it, for budgeting that a fund balance, as they politely call a surplus, should be maintained in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% of their annual budget. That's been the rule of thumb for years, and every public school district in Wisconsin, or most of them, are having to dip into that surplus now that state aid to public schools has been reduced so radically by the right wing legislation.
Interesting. Well, listen, I'm not sure what's going to happen with it, but believe me, I don't think Kevin Riley handled it very well before the legislature, but I'm not sure. Maybe there's no easy way to do it. But, I mean, again, it's not like somebody stole the money. It's there to be used, and so it's not like somebody ought to go to prison. They ought to be congratulated for saving some money, it seems to me.
You're listening to Fighting Bob Radio. I'm Eric Schubring with founder of Fighting Bob and FightingBob.com, Ed Garvey, and journalist David Giffey. And it was just this week that a group of assembly legislators, Democratic legislators, announced the formation of a rural caucus. And to tell us about it is 74th District State Representative Janet Bewley. Guys, let's welcome Janet. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
Hey, Janet, welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Hi.
Janet, as you could hear, we were just talking about the concerns that some Republican legislators have about the University of Wisconsin having a surplus. Janet, you've worked in the field of education much of your work life. Before we tell us about the rural caucus, do you have some thoughts about that criticism of the University of Wisconsin system?
Well, first of all, I think it's unfortunate that we immediately conclude that somehow we heads have to roll and we've got to punish somebody for doing something. I think that when you're talking about education, it should not be ironic, but without even thinking about the details, they are already claiming that some malfeasance has occurred. I'm not convinced of that. I believe that we need to look carefully. Critical thinking should be a part of how we do business. And if, in fact, this is a more or less a checking account balance and not, as it's been unfortunately labeled, as a slush fund, we would reach different conclusions. This is a complicated issue, and I think that...
But you're asking people to be thoughtful. It's a pretty radical thought, it seems.
Isn't that something? But, I mean, this is education, after all, and I don't think that they were trying to do something wrong or inappropriate. And, in fact, I just had Dr. Renee Wachter, who's the chancellor of the Superior campus, she was just in my office talking about how very real the cuts to education are, and from the lens that I have, which is the rural communities and the very good campus that we have in Superior, we can't punish a campus like Superior for a crime that wasn't committed. And
right.
I really think we need to look carefully at this and that reserves are necessary, and I want to find out more and look at the details before I demand anybody's head to roll.
Well, thank you, Janet. Janet, the Rural Caucus, tell us about it.
Well, I think that not only do rural communities exist, rural communities are different. And right now, as we're putting together a budget, we need to make sure that rural communities are represented in that budget. And in fact, they're not. If anything, rural communities are an afterthought. And in this day of decreasing revenues, if you're an afterthought, you're harmed. And that's where I come from right now, that if you take a lens of the rural communities in this budget, they're not only not there, they're hurt. And we needed to get legislators from rural districts to come together and figure out how we can make people aware of this.
Is it a commentary on the nature of the assembly generally that you feel it necessary to have the rural caucus? I mean, you've said they don't show up in the budget, but why so? I mean, each district is represented by each district is comprised of approximately the same number of persons. Is it just that there are so many more legislators coming out of the cities? I guess perhaps there's an obvious answer to that.
I think that number one, that's probably statistically true, that more representatives are there because they represent more dense districts. I represent the district that is the largest district in the state, and even though we're the largest district in the state, I still represent the same amount of people, 59,000 or thereabouts, and those people deserve to know that their needs and how things are different in a very, very large district like that need to be represented in the budget. And, in fact, not only are the dollars different, or they're not there, they're underfunded, but the actual policy, the way that we deliver government services, is done in such a way that rural communities are at a disadvantage than the largely populated areas.
Janet, what specific areas will you be looking at in the you're going to have some listening sessions, I understand. What sorts of, I presume public school funding will be relevant, will it not?
Oh, you're absolutely right. Anytime we go into the communities and talk, education is what people care about most. And the fact that voucher expansion has become the it is what this administration seems to think is the most important aspect of education is to expand vouchers. That is completely inconsistent with any concern about rural schools. Rural schools cannot continue under the current funding structure and with revenue caps. It is being proven again and again and again that there are very, very serious repercussions in the way it's structured. And the only solution that rural districts have is to pass a referendum where people are asked to tax themselves for the solution. And that feels so patently unfair that people vote these referendums down.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the leaders of this effort, Janet, along with yourself?
Well, I'm the chair, and the co-chair is Janice Ringhand, and she's from Evansville, south of Madison. But we have representatives from all around the state. Amy Sue Vruwink, who is in the Wisconsin Rapids area. We have Andy Jorgensen, Fred Clark, Mandy from the Wausau area. We have my own neighbor, Nick Milroy, who represents the 73rd District, Steve Smith. All of the representatives from rural areas are on the Democratic side are in this caucus. And we're very excited about the opportunity to go into rural communities and show them what this budget looks like from their perspective. Because the budget is explained in ways that make sense to cities and suburban areas, but they overlook the effect of the budget on rural districts.
I think it's a great idea, and you should congratulate it for doing it.
Well,
you'll be holding
a hearing.
Sorry.
We've had a number of hearings already. Senator Jauch and I had a hearing in Ashland. And we're hearing the very same things. Right now we've got a series of sessions in the southern part of the state, and I was just in Wisconsin Rapids last night, and a lot of rural schools were represented. There were some superintendents from rural schools there. So we are just trying to go where there haven't been hearings so that we can make sure the entire rural area of the state has been given an opportunity to speak on the budget.
Very good.
Janet, earlier we spoke with a fellow from Washington, D.C., and an institute there who's completed a study on the inequality, wealth-income inequality in the United States, but also spoke about environmental issues. We could hardly have you on Fighting Bob without your thoughts and what you see happening regarding the GTAC, the Gogebic Taconite, Pinoki Mountain mining proposal, and the bill that is passed. And also, I know frac sand mining is a very rural issue. Both of these are. Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes remaining. Can you speak to both of those, if you will?
Well. First of all, let's talk about something that we haven't talked about that much lately, and that's local control. We can look at this. We can take the mining bill, and we can find ways to criticize it from all sorts of angles. But local control, the units of government are not given enough financial support to maintain their own integrity. Number one, they are not given the financial resources to maintain their integrity, and that's critical. If local units of government cannot function, then how can they represent? And in the mining bill, since mines do not pay property tax, the amount of revenue that's going to go to local communities is non-existent through any taxation until the mine is up and running and producing a profit. So not only does it hurt them monetarily, it reduces the ability of local units of government to function. And I think that what we're seeing lately are consistent erosions of local control, what they're able to do with zoning, how they are able to staff themselves. Take a look at how this administration, this assembly, passed a bill that completely restructured the Milwaukee County government.
Yeah.
The state assembly decided that it knew better and should tell the entire county of Milwaukee how they should structure their government. Now, that's unprecedented, and it's unacceptable. That's not how this state is supposed to function. We have towns, we have cities, we have villages, and we have counties that need to be maintained in order for this democratic system to work. You can't erode them so that they can't function and then have the state take over. And that's where we're going.
Wow.
Three more.
Indeed, that's...
And then we can talk about the environmental part of the mining bill. I mean, you can go at this thing from so many angles.
But that is a powerful one. And, in fact, our earlier guest, John Talberth, again, who wrote a report on the inequality divide, speaking to the ways that corporations externalize costs and leave others to bear them, whether they are natural capital costs or infrastructure costs that are unpaid for, not being paid for, as you said, by the absence of taxation of mines, so local communities are left to deal with it until a profit is made, if a profit is ever declared.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, and you think about I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I was just going to chime in to say, or if a profit is ever admitted through the accounting
method.
Well, you know, and the state of Wisconsin in last term passed a bill, I voted against it, for what's called combined reporting, where corporations can legally move their profits to another state. It's kind of, Walmart is the poster child. Walmart pays little or no corporate tax, and it's because of combined reporting. Should we expect that Gogebic Taconite is going to do anything different?
Right, right. Janet,
it's the way
rural,
it's done.
Yeah, the
mm-hmm.
Rural Caucus will be meeting, I understand, in Sparta on the 1st, in Tolma,
mm-hmm.
on the 1st as well, in the afternoon at the high school there, in
right.
Fenimore. Also down in Monroe, down in Greene
mm-hmm.
County, in Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
You and Bob held hearings on the budget up here, well, I should say listening sessions. Unfortunately,
mm-hmm.
The formal hearings were not held here. I'm glad that you're doing this, the Rural Caucus, Janet.
And we're going to be in Wausau on Saturday. No, excuse me. We're going to be in Barron on Saturday. This is a different. Bob Jauch and I and Steve Smith and Nick Milroy are doing a strictly budget listening session in Barron on Saturday.
Excellent. Janet, thank
okay.
you very much for joining us. Unless
thank
my
you,
pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen. Bye-bye.
Be well.
Thank you.
Well, she is a busy 74th District. And David, you're still with us. Ed has dropped off now at the conclusion of the program. I understand, David, you're going to be away for a couple of weeks. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm going to the land of wonder in New Mexico, land of enchantment,
well,
where I've noticed the kinds of phenomenon from the air that our first guest, John Talberth, spoke about.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that all Fighting Bob radio programs are archived, and we've had something in the excess of 25,000 downloads of the archived programs, and we welcome you to do the same. Tell others about the program. You can find the program, as you surely did, through fightingbob.com, and folks, look for the great Robert M. Fighting Bob La Follette behind the microphone, and that's where you find us here each Thursday at 11 o'clock, Fighting Bob Radio. I'm Eric Schubert, with, of course, the founder of Fighting Bob and FightingBob.com and the Fighting Bob Festival, David, on September 7th this year.
Absolutely, and that we're lining up some really terrific guests. And I might say that I was particularly pleased with our guests on Fighting Bob Radio today. Very, very wonderful information that was made available to all of our progressive listeners.
And we thank you, David,
for
being with
Eric.
Us here as well. Be well, folks. You've been listening to Fighting Bob Radio, 11 o'clock Thursdays on Blog Talk Radio at fightingbob.com and rebroadcast on WIDE LPFM Madison.